The Navigators is an international, interdenominational Christian organization whose objective is to help fulfill Christ's commission to make disciples of all nations. They individually teach the basics of the Christian life to new believers, who then teach others. They work on campuses, military bases, and among lay men and women on every continent.
We are talking about the parent-children relationships. The second thing I would like to suggest about consideration is that our children need to know that we like him or her for himself or herself, not just because he does certain things right or wrong, but as he is. We like him as he is all the time. Now that is something that children pick up very quickly. They can sense if they're under probation. They can sense if they're under trial. They can sense if there is an acceptance of them just as a person with their idiosyncrasies, even as we have them, to accept one another as we are all the time. But when we must disapprove of something, let's be sure that we are disapproving of the action and not the person. In other words, here are some suggestions as to how we can do that. Avoid exasperated talk. Now, I don't have to tell you what exasperated talk is. Many of you are parents and you have well experienced it, just as I have. Avoid that. In other words, if you feel that way right at that moment, take a few moments to bring yourself under composure and make sure you can express how you feel without exasperation in your voice. For example, such a phrase as, "Oh my goodness, when will you ever learn to..." whatever, you know. Or, "How long must I keep telling you..." ta-ta-ta-ta-ta. And so on. These exasperated phrases that really communicate a rejection of the person rather than a dealing with the action. Critical expressions, blaming expressions, or generalizing expressions. Now, in the area of liking our child for himself or herself, the third thing I want to mention is the importance of helping them develop a positive self-image. A positive self-image. Now, there are a variety of ways in which we can do this. The first way, of course, is to come through the scriptural way. And this is to utilize such passages as 1 Corinthians 12 through 26, where it talks about the entire body and how every member of the body is important to God and how He has placed every member in that body just where He wants. And He has prepared them to do just what they can do most effectively to help fulfill the functioning of the body. Now, we can begin teaching our children that as soon as they're able to comprehend such facts. That alone, if I may suggest it to you, that alone is one of the most significant contributions to a self-image that is positive. And incidentally, may I suggest it for your consideration just for yourselves? And if I can see myself from God's perspective and see how He accepts me as a unique member of His body, prepared for a specific task, whatever that might be. Not only that, but if I can see Him therefore accepting me and my willingness to accept myself on that basis. God accepts me, therefore I'm what I should be. I don't have to try to be someone else. I don't have to try to be like someone else. I don't have to try to perform like someone else performs. God made me the way I am. Therefore, I can be happy with myself. Now, the product of that kind of thinking, the product of being able to see myself from God's point of view and accept myself on that basis, allows me to accept you with a greater degree of personal acceptance. You see, I really can't accept someone else until I accept myself. Because I am always in competition. When I am insecure about myself, I'm always comparing myself with you when we talk. I'm always in in a little bit of apprehension, competition, and comparison. But if I can say, here I am, I'm just me. I don't have anything to cover up. I'm not trying to impress anyone. This is how God made me. This is how I function best. If I can do that, I can also reach out and accept someone else on the same basis. Oh, how important it would be, how helpful it would be, and how important it is that we help our children learn to begin to accept themselves on that basis as early as we can. Help them develop their self-image. In this passage that I mentioned, 1 Corinthians 12, 12 through 26, verse 18, I think, is the key verse. As it is, God arranged the organs in the body, each one of them as He chose. There's the key. As He chose. I look at you, at this crowd here, and I see individuals. Each one fashioned just as God chose. And I know you have a special place to fill because God said that. And I'd like to encourage you to believe that. And then encourage your children to believe that as early as you can communicate that to them. Another point in this area of accepting a child just for who he is or she is, liking them just as they are, is that we must consider the fallacy of always rewarding them for what they accomplish, what they do, as, quote, an effort to show appreciation, unquote. Let me read for you, if I may, from some findings that have been compiled in interviewing teenagers across the United States. These are both Christian and non-Christian in their orientation. These are just typical teenage responses. There were a number of them. I only picked a few. I'll be using them intermittently to communicate some of these thoughts. These are teenagers. And at this point, this is what they say. Don't reward me with dollar bills for each A I make. Not everything has a price tag. A word of appreciation is sometimes more valuable than a reward. And that's right. Our children are more sensitive to honesty than we are sometimes. And they know that many times we reward them with these gifts of one kind or another because we are unwilling to take the time to express appreciation in more meaningful ways. In other words, it's an easy way to get out of a personal responsibility. And in this materialistic world in which we live, The impression is quickly given that anything can be bought. One thing I learned about teenagers, I'll just interject at this point, is that as much as anything else, they appreciate honesty. And if you don't know what you're talking about, admit it. Don't try to con them. They'll see through you so fast. Honesty, real honesty. This is true of children at younger ages as well, but I'm thinking now of teenagers since we were mentioning that. All right, under consideration then, not only that parents love, want, and enjoy him, not only that his parents like him for himself just as he is, but third, in the area of consideration, his home is a safe place. His home is a safe place. His parents are available. He belongs, or he fits into that unit. He has a contribution that he feels he can make. He senses security and protection. His home is a safe place. This is part of consideration for our children. Let's take little children. The matter of play. In our highly motivated society today, we are constantly achievement-oriented. And so toys have to be, quote, educational, unquote. And we're always trying to find toys, hopefully, to help our children develop in some way. Now, that's not wrong. Please believe me, that is not wrong. There is a good place for that. But my plea is that play itself is serious business to a child. Just playing. They have to think. They have to try to determine what it is they want to do and how to do it. They're going through a process of development, just playing. Don't try to formulate and structure and give them all kinds of meaningful educational things to follow. Let them be children and play. That in itself is a very developmental experience. And yet today, there is a feeling among our parents that just playing is wasting time. It's irresponsibility. I don't know what it is, but I don't see that many kids lying out on the grassy hillsides just staring at clouds. I've read about parents that get concerned when their children start doing that. They think there's something wrong with them, that somehow they're maladjusted socially, or somehow they're mentally deficient because they're not interested in projects that demand thinking. Oh, listen, they are thinking. They're looking at those clouds and they're seeing all kinds of images and their imagination is just running wild. And it's a very developmental experience, and we hardly give children that kind of opportunity to develop sometimes. Everything has to be so carefully guarded and structured. Let's let children play and be children and develop in those areas that they can develop in their playing business. Second, this place of security that we're talking about. Let's include our children in decision making as early as possible. Now, that doesn't mean we decide to do what they would like all the time. But it does mean we allow them to express what their likes, what their preferences are. The earlier we can do that, the sooner they begin to learn how to make decisions. And incidentally, we are on the way. You remember one of the things we said was that we are seeking to help them learn personal responsibility. One of the areas of personal responsibility is that of decision making. And we are in the process, from the time they are born, we are in the process of either helping them become effective, responsible decision makers, or very dependent, irresponsible decision makers. We set as our goal, though I'm not sure we defined it that specifically, and yet we may have, I don't remember the details, but I know that in our minds we had as our goal having our children ready to live as independent human beings by the time they were 18 years of age and ready to leave our home for college. That was our goal. And by the time they reached that place, we felt that we had made the contribution that we could to their lives by way of those things which we could share with them. And now we were ready to see how well that had taken. That's a rather frightening experience, by the way. Some of you have been through that, and you know what I'm talking about. But we were in the process of doing that from the very beginning. Part of the way in which we can accomplish that is to get them involved in decision-making. Reading again from this teenage survey, this is a very interesting comment. Some of you may have questions about this, but listen. You say that you want to spare me, and that's why you shut the door when you two fight. I suppose I can't solve all the world's problems, but who knows? In this case, maybe I can help. In any event, I'd like to feel needed. Parents ask me, is it good to have conflicts in front of your children? It is good if you resolve them and show them how you're willing to resolve them. Yes. Because that's part of life, and that's realistic. And there isn't anything wrong with having a disagreement that you're willing to work out in front of your children. Including them in decisions and decision-making, letting them contribute to the development of the family and the home. A third area of safety that we're talking about in the home, and that is personal privacy. Let your children know from the very beginning, as early as is possible and necessary, that they have certain things that are theirs and certain areas that are private. As you're able to, depending on the circumstances, let them have their room and you show privacy for them, or rather respect for their privacy. I can remember when the children would close the door in their rooms, the tendency was to wonder what was going on. But we began to realize and understand that we needed to communicate to them confidence that we believed they were going to do the proper thing, and we would not open that door and barge in there. We'd knock at the door before we opened it, just as we expected them to knock at our door. You see, consideration for privacy is a two-way street. We want them to consider our privacy, and we must consider theirs as well. And by and large, I want to encourage you, parents, children will respond when they know you are placing your confidence in them. Oh, they'll mess it up sometimes, and they'll fail just as you and I do. But when they know you are placing your confidence in them, they will respond in kind. They really will. I could give you a number of stories of teenagers where this has been proven true time and time and time again. Personal privacy. Here's what they say. While on the subject of privacy, please don't search my drawers or my closet or try to force open my diary. You wouldn't want me to search your personal things. If you suspect something, come right out and ask me. Home is a safe place. That's part of safety. And then finally, in this area of the home being a safe place and the parents being available, is this whole matter of prior attention, priorities. Just as I said in the husband-wife relationship, that when a wife knows that her husband will give her the time and attention that she needs whenever the need arises, so the children, if they are assured of that kind of consideration, they won't take advantage of it, but it provides such a fantastic security for them knowing Mom and Dad are available. When I need them, they're there. That is so important. When I need them, they're there. Again, that does not communicate, at least I do not intend that it should communicate, quantity of time as much as quality. You see, many mothers are home all day long, but their children don't get that much attention. Children come in, go out, and the mother's hardly aware of it because she's so involved in her own little private pursuits. It isn't how much time you happen to be available, but what you do with the time that you do have with your children. The quality, not the quantity, of that time. And in this matter of prior attention, when they have a need, when they come and ask you, or when they come and express a fear to you, please, parents, don't ignore their fear or try to explain it away with some little casual remark like, well, you don't have to be afraid of that. Facts are they are afraid of it. Don't ignore the fact. The best thing to do is acknowledge it. Admit the fact that it probably is very real to them. Talk it over with them. Discuss it with them. Explain what you can. But please don't just pass it off as a childish foible of some kind. Fears are very real. What they need at that point, again, is knowing that you're there. Encourage them. Pray with them. Talk to them about the reality of God. These are experiences that can be utilized as fantastic stepping stones to sharing truth. Encourage them with your presence. See, home. Home is to be a place of safety, knowing that Mom and Dad are there, available. And so we have those 3 points under the area of consideration. And now the second major area, and that has to do with correction. Correction, which is a very real part of our relationship with our children. Correction. Proverbs 13, 24, 18, 22, 15, and many, many other passages in the book of Proverbs. I would recommend just studying the entire book to get guidelines. There are so many in this particular book of Proverbs. But 15, the verse that I just mentioned, 22:15, is probably one that summarizes pretty much what we're trying to accomplish here. Foolishness or folly is bound up in the heart of a child, but the rod of discipline or correction drives it far from him. Foolishness is bound up in the heart of a child. The rod of correction will drive it far from him. Now, we'll talk about this further as we go along. The first thing I would like to mention in this matter of correction is the goal of correction or discipline, if you please. And that is that our goal is the development of responsible behavior. This is where a lot of that falls into its proper relationship. Underlying all discipline, underlying all correction, there must be one basic foundational concept, and that is, I care for you. Whom the Lord loves, he chastens and scourges every son whom he receives. Love is the underlying stone of foundation that makes me respond positively to the discipline and the correction of God. I know he cares for me. And even when his discipline is difficult for me and hard on me, I know it's because he loves me. Now, I must learn to communicate that same concept to my son or daughter. I care. I love you. I'm interested in you. This is part of my desire to help you, this whole concept of correction and discipline. Now, we accomplish this in a variety of ways. But first of all, what we're trying to do is learn life's requirements in a context of love. You see, if they do not learn these requirements in our home in a context of love, you can rest assured they are going to learn them in a context that may not be loving. When they get out among their peers or into another section of responsibility or experience in life. And so we're doing them a favor to try and adjust their lifestyle to some of the requirements of life in a context of love. Secondly, there is a great deal of difference between discipline or proper correction and punishment. Punishment, first of all, is penalty for an offense. This is not what we're trying to communicate. There may be occasions when that is necessary. This is not what we mean when we talk of discipline or corrective action. You see, discipline and corrective action should always have as their basis the positive development of that child, growth. Punishment does not necessarily contribute to that, though it may, depending on how punishment is meted out. The attitude with which punishment is meted out. Punishment can be discipline. Discipline does not have to be punishment. There is a great difference. So punishment is a penalty for offense. Too often, however, punishment is given out in hostility and frustration. More for the good of the parent than for the good of the child. More for the venting of the parent's frustrations than for the child's development. And I think, generally speaking, punishment produces fear and guilt, where discipline and correction produce encouragement and growth. By contrast, then, discipline is to train or correct for development. Discipline has as its goal, as its objective, development. Second, discipline has as its base, as we have already stated, love and concern. Discipline is always based on love and concern, real concern. And finally, in contrast to punishment, discipline produces security rather than fear. Discipline produces security. Now, in the matter of discipline, The second thing I would like to say under this matter of correction is that there is need for a united front. By that I mean, Mom and Dad need to be in agreement, not only regarding how you are going to administer discipline, but the standard that you are desirous of maintaining. There must be agreement. Some of you have experienced the disastrous effects of not being in agreement, where one or the other is more tolerant, more lenient, and how quickly the children sense that, and how quickly they utilize it to drive a wedge even between the parents. You recall what we said earlier? The greatest contribution you can make to your children is the security of your relationship, your agreement. That will communicate more to them than anything else. And in this area of discipline, the security of knowing that Mom and Dad agree. They may not like it all the time, and they may not agree with you all the time, but the fact that they know that Mom and Dad agree is a fantastically secure experience for them. I have had young people of teenage, in the teenage category and younger, of course, say to me more than once how much they appreciate having limits and knowing that there are limits in which they have to live. They do not like to have open-ended privileges. They want limits set for them. They realize their own need for this. And when they don't have it, they find themselves struggling in an area of frustration because they're expected to do something for which they do not feel prepared. A united front, agreement of standards, agreement of methods, and then mutual reinforcement. Whoever is on the scene when the infraction takes place needs to be the one who takes on the responsibility of administering whatever disciplinary or corrective measures are necessary. Dad doesn't say, well, go on in the kitchen and tell your mom what you did. And Mom doesn't say, boy, wait till Dad gets home. No. Whoever is on the scene seeks to carry this out as much as possible. There are times when there may be the need for the stronger hand of the father to assist the mother in a particularly needy situation. Generally speaking, this principle that I've enunciated holds true. Third, there is this need for a united front, and we are still in the area of correction. Every child needs to know that parents want him to grow up. Listen to this carefully now. Independently dependent on the Lord and His Word. Now, I'm talking about children in a Christian context, obviously. Children in a Christian context. They need to know that we are seeking to help them grow up to be independent of us and yet dependent on the Lord and on His Word. Independently dependent. Now, this cannot be forced, first of all. You can't force a child into independence. You need to encourage it. You can't smother it. You mustn't smother it. Take an infant you want the child to learn to feed themselves. They'll feed themselves when they get to the point where they feel confident in doing it. You encourage them. You give them opportunities, but you don't force that. It's not that big a deal. Oh, but our neighbor's child fed themselves at, 5 months. And so we're working at that. No, we don't worry about that. Here is an individual. We try to encourage independence at their level and at their speed. Don't compare. Each child is different. Even in your own family, each child is different. And so we must give them the prerogative of individuality. In this area of independence, we mentioned the matter of decision making. Begin by offering them choices in relatively simple and non-problematic situations. You do this by explaining it to them, by helping them understand the consequences, and then letting them make a couple of decisions. They may blow it, they may do the wrong thing, they may spend their money for something that isn't worth it, and all the rest of it. This is how they learn. Now, there are three kinds of decision-making situations that I would like to share. One, where the parent has a definite opinion and preference. If you have a preference and an opinion, express it. Don't say, well, whatever you'd like, and then come back later to make it rough on the child because they didn't decide what you wanted. If, in fact, you have a preference, let it be known. Second, don't imply that your child can make a decision if already you have come to a conclusion in your mind. That isn't honest. Don't imply that they can make a decision if the decision has already been made and you know what's going to happen. And then finally, the third kind of decision-making situation is where the parent has no preference. It really doesn't make any difference. If that's true, then let them make the decision and enjoy with them or suffer with them the consequences of that decision. Now, I think that there needs to be, obviously, prohibition. All right, let's review these three kinds of situations. First, the parent has a definite opinion and preference. That's the first kind. And if that's true, they need to express this. Second, the second kind of situation is where you have already come to a conclusion in your mind, then don't imply that the child can decide. The third is where the parent has no particular preference. And therefore, it doesn't make any difference what kind of decision is made. Now, one warning. There must always be prohibition where there may be possible permanent or serious harm, obviously. This is part of our responsibility as parents. Where they don't know what they're deciding, then we need to help them by virtue of information and prohibition wherever necessary. One final area, and that's the matter of choosing friends. When they choose their friends, as they get older especially, reserve judgment. You may not like what you see outwardly, but reserve judgment. Expose yourself to those children or that young man or woman. Try to get acquainted with them. Examine your own prejudices. And if after all of that is over with, you still have reservations, then discuss it with your child. Let them know how you feel honestly. You're not trying to choose their friends. You're simply telling them what reservations you have. And after discussing it with your child, then you must determine whatever course of action is acceptable to both of you. And that can vary. The matter of homework. Many parents ask about this. Just these suggestions. Remember, homework is basically self-discipline. Don't get caught in the trap of being the enforcer. This is something that child needs to work out in his relationship or her relationship with the teacher. Now, you can encourage, you can make arrangements, make sure they have a desk at which they can study, whatever they need, but don't you be the one to sit there and force them and say, come on, let's get that homework done. They can bear the results of that one way or the other, and it may be the best learning situation they've ever gone through. So don't get caught in the trap of being the enforcer of homework. Then, there are limits, and the parents will reinforce the limits. This is basically in the establishment and respect for authority. We've talked about it. In the early years, you may have to enforce it by physical action. All right? Here's a 3-year-old. It's time to go to bed. We take their hand and we lead them toward the bedroom. Or a 2-year-old. And we begin to associate in their mind the command with the enforcement. And this proceeds through life in a variety of ways. Later, they're sitting in the living room reading or playing, and you go in and say, it's time for dinner. You don't stand in the dining room and say, come and eat. You go in and you say, come, let's go and eat. And you help them go and eat. And it only takes a few times like that where you enforce physically. And when I say physically, I don't mean in a disciplinary measure. I simply mean that you do whatever is necessary physically to enforce the command that has been given. And you go ahead on that basis. Little by little, they associate the command with the action. Now, in the event that they do not respond to those kinds of physical encouragements, then we need to use other physical encouragements. Disciplinary processes, such as the word utilizes. These are proper, and they are right, and We will continue to talk about these in just a moment. But the reinforcement physically of the command that is given. Discipline must always be fair, prompt, and terminal. Fair, prompt, and terminal. Ecclesiastes 8:11 is a key text in this area. And I would like to give you an explanation briefly of these three words, fair, prompt, and terminal. First of all, fair. What do we mean by fair? Well, I believe it should be explained and understood. That is to say, why are they being disciplined? I think it needs to be that you take the time to explain to them what the infraction was, therefore why this has to be done. Now, it may be that it's a first offense. This is something you have to evaluate. If, in fact, it is a first offense, if, in fact, they didn't know what they were supposed to do or that it was wrong, then we need to take the time on that first offense to explain to them what we expect by way of behavior in that given situation the next time. Once we have done that, we needn't go back over that explanation again. That's why it has to be clear and understood. And I often made a practice of having them repeat it back to me. Just because by verbalizing it themselves, it reinforces it in their thinking. And so I would tell them, and then I would say, now, what is it that we're not going to do again? And what's going to happen if you do it again? And we would make it very clear. And the next time it happened, there was no need to go through any of that again. We simply dealt with the offense at that particular moment. So, it must be explained and understood. Secondly, under fair, you need to avoid disciplining in impatience, because usually that's a utilization of poor judgment when we do it in impatience. So, we need to be careful not to discipline in impatience. Part of being fair is to be composed so that our judgment is right. And then the third thing under fair is the discipline or corrective action should fit the offense. Don't get carried away and utilize a given kind of discipline for every offense, because some of them don't deserve that kind of discipline. So we have to fit the discipline or the corrective action to the offense. How that's to be done is something that you and your wife or you and your husband must work out in your context and depending on the need of the child. Some children are so sensitive that the whole process of corrective action and discipline needs to be adjusted to that. Others are different and need a little more stern and direct involvement. So each one has to be determined individually as you deal with these situations. The second area, prompt, we said it should be fair, prompt, and terminal. Under prompt, I'm simply trying to communicate as soon after the offense as possible. I think that particularly in small children, the longer time you allow to go by, the harder it is for them to identify why it is they're being disciplined. So the sooner it can come to the time of the offense, the more effective it will probably be. Secondly, we've suggested this, but I put it into this context as well, and that is that it should be administered by the parent that is present when the offense takes place, if this is at all possible. Now, obviously, there are situations in which it may not be possible. Those need to be kept in mind, and this is not a hard and fast rule, but rather a guideline, generally speaking. And then finally, terminal. Terminal. By this we mean no continuing reminders. You remember what you did yesterday? And such remarks as that. Terminal in the sense that judgment has been meted out, whatever that was, however you took care of it, and it is past and over with. We've learned from that, hopefully, and we're going to go on and learn what's coming up next. Secondly, under terminal, there should be immediate reacceptance of the child. However that needs to be demonstrated, physically, verbally, however we can demonstrate it, immediate reacceptance of the child. This will not damage the effect of the discipline as some parents feel. On the contrary, it will reinforce the effect of that discipline. And again, we go back to our relationship with the Father. He does not hold us at arm's length when we come and confess our sin. He does not hold it against us anymore. Rather, we are reaccepted into the fellowship with Him immediately. That fellowship which had been interrupted and tarnished by our sin, that fellowship is immediately reestablished. If any man thirst, let him come to me and drink. John 7:37. And then finally, under terminal judgment, let's remember that the sentence or the disciplinary measure that we choose may require some time to fulfill. For example, in a teenage son, you may decide that you're going to take away the privileges of using the car for a month. So it's going to take a month for that to be fulfilled. But in the process, he is accepted. Your relationship with him is reestablished, even though the fact is that the sentence has to be carried out over a process of time. So discipline must be fair, prompt, and terminal. Another point, and that has to do with physical discipline. Let's consider that for just a moment. Physical discipline. I don't believe it's necessary for me to remind you, but I will nevertheless, that physical discipline is scripturally approved, instructed. We've said that the entire book of Proverbs deals with this in a variety of ways. Proverbs 13:24 and 23:13. And I realize that in many of our current thinking, many of our current psychologists' thinking, particularly child psychologists, there is a greater and greater tendency away from this. Now, may I suggest one of the reasons for this? That is that, generally speaking, this is the most misused of all disciplinary processes. And so as a result, there is a tendency to react against the misuse of this and to, quote, throw the baby out with the bathwater, unquote. Physical disciplinary measures serve a real purpose at the right time and need to be utilized properly, but not overused, not in a destructive way. They need to be reserved for the necessary time. Now a question comes up immediately. Well, how should we do this? And there are many advocates that say you should never use your hand to discipline your child because they will react against your hand somehow and they'll be afraid of you. I question that. I do not agree with that basic concept. The reason for that is that Psalm 32:4, for example, the psalmist talks about the hand of the Lord being heavy upon him. And yet the same psalmist turns around and writes about the hand of God which led him and extended itself in mercy to him. Or you take the statement in Job 19:21, and again he talks about the hand of the Lord being heavy on him. And yet it was the same hand that extended itself in love and restoration to Job. I'm suggesting to you that in my relationship with my children, the same hand that metes out discipline at times is the hand that should always be extending love and acceptance. Now, this is not to say that we can't use the rod. The Bible talks about the rod very clearly. Spoons, rods, whatever you want, whatever is most useful to you, most convenient. Obviously, it makes sense to realize we must be very careful not to injure our children in the area of physical discipline. I personally cannot tolerate when I see someone striking their children in the face, on the head, and that type of so-called disciplinary measure. To me, that is a disruption of my child's personal prestige. There are ways to administer physical discipline in which that is not demonstrated. I've watched parents as I've sat at their tables where the husband will reach across and knock them on the head when they're misbehaving. And I think, how tragic. Or flip them with his finger or her finger. I suggest to you that in the administration of physical discipline, a great deal of consideration for them as people needs to be kept in mind. But I also suggest that I personally, and I speak for myself, I personally do not agree with nor endorse for myself this matter of not using your hand in discipline. When it is properly done, as we have suggested, with immediate reacceptance and done in love and concern, the child is not going to associate that with rejection. And that hand, that same hand, can extend love and acceptance to that child as well. And finally, in the matter of correction, pick your battlefields carefully when you are demanding respect for authority. In other words, don't pit the child's will against yours in every issue. We do this too often over non-essentials. And then we have to follow through with some kind of judgment because otherwise they are defying our authority. The problem is not in their attitude necessarily. The problem is that we're making an issue out of something that should not be an issue. So pick your battlefields. Make certain that the thing that's being done is important enough to demand the use of your authority rather than just a suggestion. Now, once that has been established, once you have established the limits of authority and the child is rebelling against your authority or defying that authority, then, of course, you are in the area of an arena of challenge, and it's at that point that we have to help our children learn what it is to respect authority. Now for our final point, and that is consistency. Consistency. We've talked about consideration. We've talked about correction. And now, consistency. Psalm 15:4 talks about keeping my word even when it hurts me. If I've given my word, even though it may hurt me, I am to follow through on that. Let's start out with first, self-discipline, consistency in self-discipline or self-control on my part as a parent. Proverbs 25:28 and Galatians 5:22 and 23. Let me read a short paragraph from the pen of William Glasser out of his book, Reality Therapy. This is a psychologically oriented book which has some excellent thoughts if you're interested in that type of thing. Regarding the area of personal responsibility. Listen to what he says. The child who does not learn both by example and instruction will not respect his parents. When discipline is reasonable and understandable, and when the parents' own behavior is consistent with their demands on the child, he will love and respect them, even though his surface attitude may not always show it. And so, in consistency, in the matter of consistency, the first thing is consistency in personal self-control. And if I am asking them to live and act and behave in certain ways, I must be willing to do that first. Call it pace setting, call it an example, call it whatever you will. That's part of consistency, and that's first. Second, under consistency, remember, your children will do what you do, not what you say. Basically, they will learn from your behavior, not from your preaching. And I told you earlier, one of the first things that children recognize is dishonesty. They can see through fraud and hypocrisy faster than anybody else. It's your life that's going to make the difference. Take, for example, the matter of courtesy to their mother. Young men learn to be courteous to their mother and thus to other women by observing their father being courteous to their mother, being thoughtful. Young ladies learn to accept the kindliness of gentlemanliness because their father demonstrates it to them as well. All of these things are observed, learned, caught, not taught. And it starts with consistency in my life. Third, under consistency. This is especially important in discipline. The other day I was in a supermarket here locally. And just ahead of me in the line, as I was waiting to go through with my basket, there was a lady and her husband. They were both there and a child. And they had him in the basket. I would assume the child was about 4, maybe a little more. And he was reaching out and grabbing everything. Now, in this particular supermarket, as we go into the area where we get the charge, they have these racks of gum and rolls and all, you know, these sweet candy rolls and all this. And the child would reach over and grab one and almost pull a whole box down. And one of them would look over and, "Don't do that." And they take it out and put it back and turn away and start talking and looking around. And I'm standing here watching this whole thing going on. And he's reaching over for the next one. Now, this went on, without exaggeration, 15 times while we were waiting in that line. And every time, the same thing. And I thought, what a tragedy. If those parents knew what they're doing to that child. They pushed the cart in. They got near the cash register, and the child reached up and started to grab and hit all the buttons. The parents didn't do a thing. Finally, the checkout lady reached over and grabbed his hand and held it in hers and tried to be kind to him as she finished adding up these things. The parents didn't say a word, not one word. They were watching this entire process. I think, what a tragedy for that child. No understanding of basic personal responsibility and consideration because the parents are just too indifferent and too lazy to demonstrate some consistency in this area. It's just easier to be inconsistent, but the damage is unbelievable. How many times have you heard, or perhaps we have been guilty ourselves at times of saying, "Now if you do that again," and they do it, and nothing happens. You see, it only takes 2 or 3 times of that kind of pattern, and they begin to realize they can get away with it. So the point is, if you really mean it, then it's not if you do that again. But it's we don't do that, and we make certain of that. By the way, the word no, N-O. There are some psychologists who say you shouldn't use that with your children. It's a self-defeating pattern. And I say to you, God says no about many things. Very clearly, without reservation, without apology. No. And we need to use that word with our children. I remember when our little son, Steve, if my memory is right, I think it was Steve, one of our 3 children, at about X number of months, I'm afraid to say what number because I don't remember, but let's say 8 months, which would be about right, holding him in your hand, in your arms, and he reaches up and grabs the glasses. Well, now that's understandable. He's right there, and the glasses are dark, and they're right in front of him, and he's just learning to focus his eyes, and he sees this, and he grabs it. So there's no problem with that. He doesn't know what he's doing. So I have to help him learn. And I reach up, and I disentangle his fingers from my glasses, and I put his arm down, and I say, "No." And I hold him, keep holding him. Pretty soon up comes his hand again. And he's got him again. So I reach up, and this time I disentangle them, take his wrist, and as I put it down, I squeeze it just a little bit to let him know it's a little more firm. And I say, "No." Keep rocking him. His hand goes up again. That's the fact. This is what actually happened. and grabs it again. Take his hand, bring it down. Just a slight slap. No, to reinforce with a physical action. It only took three or four times of that kind till he got the picture. It really does work if we just are willing to be consistent. Consistency in disciplining our children. Fulfilling our word, fulfilling our commitments, not only in discipline, but in our enjoyment of them. Now, in conclusion, we've looked at a number of responsibilities, but I want to conclude with this thought. What is my basic responsibility? What is your basic responsibility as a parent? Proverbs 14:26, to me, summarizes this about as well as anything. In the fear of the Lord, one has strong confidence, and his children will have a refuge. What is my responsibility? My responsibility is to fear or honor, respect the Lord in my life. Glorify him and seek to serve him to the best of my ability. That is my responsibility. First of all, regarding personal areas of responsibility before the Lord, and second, in this area of my parental responsibilities, fearing and honoring the Lord. And secondly, in conclusion, we must always remember our children are individuals. They have the privilege of individual choice. They have the privilege of choosing to be miserable, just as anyone else does. Our hope is in the Lord. The Lord God who created heaven and earth and who said, he who has begun a good work in you will perform it until the day of Jesus Christ. The Lord God who said, there shall no evil befall thee, nor any plague come nigh thy dwelling. The Lord God who said, it is he who works in you to will and do of his good pleasure. This is our hope for our children. But we must always remember that they must make their agreement with God individually, just as we have. We cannot do that for them. We cannot carry that responsibility. They have that privilege before God. And certainly, Psalm 78, 5 through 7, the passage that we've looked at, our desire is that they should learn to set their hope in God. And I believe with all my heart, as we follow these guidelines in Scripture, and as we seek to walk obediently before the Lord, we will see the results of His promises, because God is not a man that He should lie, nor the Son of Man that He should repent. Above all, remember, children are a gift from God. So enjoy them. And let them know that you enjoy them. And the Lord bless you in this exciting venture if God privileges you with that. Thank you very much.